south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started. Today we'll start out with an interesting email that's entitled, Consults and Curiosities. She says, hey Johnny, I'm very interested in moving our entire family to Latin America, but, and this is a big but, I never hear of whole families moving. It seems it's always the young, single people, usually men, empty nesters or retirees, etc. Anyway, we are a family of four, my husband, me, and two little kids, ages 3.5 and 18 months. We live in a nice suburb of Denver, 5-bedroom house, 2-car garage, a dog, an ermite homestead, kinda. That is, we grow a big garden and have chickens. We have nearly everything we need, so I rarely drive more than 10 minutes to anywhere. Seems idyllic, right? Yuck. Fact is, I'm exhausted from just working constantly, feeling like I've got no time and never a vacation. Childcare costs more than most people make in a month. And I just know there has to be a way to live a more relaxed life and not spend everything we make. Question, Johnny, do people with families move to Latin America too? What resources are around for childcare? What about the schools? And what about Latin America? Is it truly safe? My husband and I are both advanced in the martial arts, but we can't be right next to our kids 24/7. I do see the opportunities for us there. I have 2 internet businesses now and a BA in psychology, so I could teach English for a while we were getting situated and building a network. Just listen to that episode you had on the Gringo Advantage for teaching English. My husband is a glazer, meaning commercial glass installation. His alter ego is Spider-Man, by the way. Not sure if that skilled trade exists there. Seems it may be just a standard construction job there, and here it's a well-paid trade. Would love to come to your July seminar, but it's out of the question as for now, as I'm pouring all into building businesses at the moment. It would be great if you had a non-first world hotel stay option for your seminars. I backpacked in Peru for a month and stayed in a hostel that was just fine. I don't always need to travel fancy. Anyway, I would love to hear an episode on the Expat Files concerning these issues. Thanks and keep up the fun and no-nonsense show. Signed, B. As in the letter B, not as in Aunt B from Andy Griffith. Anyway, she sounds too young and feisty to be an old Aunt B, that's for sure. Aunt B, now there's an image, huh? I don't think she was much of a martial artist, but I wouldn't want to get in the ring with her. Anyway, let's hit these points here. First, she asks, do people with families move to Latin America? Well, I can tell you this. I've had some young parents come down to my Latin American Insiders seminar, and that was the first step in their plan B. They went back home, got things together, and came back down with the family. So yes, I personally know a number of families that have moved down here permanently, with their kids, of course, and one family even came down with the kids and grandma. And of course, when they came down with the family after the seminar, they rented for a while, and their main idea was exactly the same as our emailer, B. To have a nice house, some land, somewhere outside a big city, and have dogs, chickens, aardvarks, whatever, and grow some of their own food. Homesteaders, basically. In fact, if you do come down to my Expat Insider Seminar, I'll put you in touch with those people and you can find out exactly what their steps were and how they did it, what to do and what not to do, and gain some extremely valuable insights and tips firsthand that you'll never get by just searching the internet and checking out blog sites. And that's what's so great about the seminar. You get an instant network of friends and expats that have gone through what you plan on going through shortly. Which is why, by the way, John Galt calls his website thenewexpat.com. He came down as a brand new expat, and now he's got 3.5 years into the venture. And guess why he came down that very first time? To come to my seminar, which is why fresh green expats could learn a lot from him. That's why people say you get a 2 to 5 year head start on becoming an expat just by coming down to the seminar. I didn't make that up. That's what people are saying. So if the best thing about the seminar is meeting all those like-minded people, as well as getting an instant expat and professional network to lean on, well, that's not all, not by a long shot. People have told me they think the second best thing about the seminar is that they learn what not to do. how not to make those stupid, costly mistakes so many fresh green expats make when they first get down. But I digress as usual. Let's get back to the email. Then B asks, what resources are available in Latin America regarding childcare? Whoa. Practically every gringo and expat family I know has a maid and a gardener, and some families with kids have live-in nannies. In fact, another family that's down here now permanently that first came to one of my expat insider seminars, they've got one kid around 2 years old and the wife's pregnant again. They live in a very nice guarded gated community and they have a gardener come in once a week. They've got a maid that comes in two times a week and they've got a full-time live-in nanny. Now, the mom said she tried it both ways. She had a nanny come in every day from around 7 in the morning to 4 or 5 at night, with Sunday being the nanny's day off. But eventually, the mom decided to have a full-time live-in nanny. That way, the kid's taken care of 24/7. By the way, the expat lady said that her husband was not involved in the nanny selection process until the very end. Only after she interviewed and selected some ugly and homely ones was he involved in the final selection process. Smart lady, huh? Now, get this. She pays her live-in nanny around $250 a month. And, of course, the nanny gets room and board. Now, B says in Colorado, child care costs more than most people make in a month. So, B, how does $250 a month sound to you? Oh, and by the way, down here in Latin America, if you wish, your nanny will double as a cook and housekeeper, too. In fact, they're so used to doing all three, you probably won't be able to stop her from cooking and cleaning. Now, about schools, I've talked a lot about that in past shows, but just to mention that you could send your kids to one of those high-end, private helicopter schools, as I call them. They're completely bilingual and sometimes trilingual. Usually around 25 to 50% of the teachers are from the States. By all accounts, kids get a terrific education and classes are so small you won't believe it. In fact, a friend of mine, gringo expat with a family down here, told me that his kid is in a class of 14 and they have four teachers at all times. Two who speak in Spanish all the time, and two who speak nothing but English because, well, they're gringos and their Spanish sucks. But that's what they're there for, to teach in American-style English. So what do these schools cost? Well, the very highest, most elite schools will run around $300 to $500 a month. Now, remember, your kids will be rubbing elbows with the kids of the rich and famous and the movers and shakers in Latin America. They're the 1% or 2% that can afford to send their kids there. Whereas for a gringo, $300 to $500 a month to send your kid to the most elite school is not a deal breaker. However, your kid will be friends and best buddies with many spoiled, entitled, rich kids with bodyguards, etc. Which is both good and bad. On the positive side, with the gringo advantage, your kid will certainly be a superstar at that school. Not to mention, he'll be socially positioned in the stratosphere forever. Why? Because your kid will be friends with and connected forever with the movers and shakers in his Latin country. On the other hand, those little rich kids tend to be racist, classist, and elitist, just like their parents. Sound familiar? Anyway, you've got those high-end helicopter schools. Then in every market, there's maybe another dozen or so middle-priced private K-12 schools. The difference is they don't have gigantic luxury campuses, just a few first-world gringo teachers, and not nearly as many entitled rich kids. They're 100% bilingual, of course, and of good quality, yet they only cost between maybe $200 and $300 a month. Oh, and by the way, there are more options. For example, another expat family, whose father attended one of my expat insider seminars, they moved down permanently about a year ago. And their very intelligent mother homeschools their three kids, and she did that when they were back in the States, too. She's an expert at it. So all you expat gonna-bes and wannabes with families up in the States, that mother is definitely a person you want to network with if you come down here to Latin America. So you can see there are lots and lots of options. And then B asks in her email, is it truly safe in Latin America? Well, I always like to say that there are really two Latin Americas. The one you see on TV up in the States with the gangs and the tattoos and the scummy, disgusting neighborhoods that house the people with nothing to lose who eventually end up in the States and then they become your problem. Then there's the Latin America that smart expats live, work, play, and or do business. Those places that are nearly first world. In fact, if the signs weren't all in Spanish and the people were a bit taller, you'd think that you were in a nice upscale neighborhood in your own community. So yes, in every Latin big city, there are a lot of places you want to keep away from, but there are just as many nice, clean, safe places too. By the way, you been to Harlem, the south side of Chicago, East St. Louis, or Atlanta, Georgia lately? How about East LA, Cleveland, Philadelphia, or New Orleans. In fact, did you know that New Orleans has a higher murder rate per capita than the majority of the cities in Latin America? But let's move on. So then B says her husband is a skilled glazer. That's a commercial glass installer. Kind of a real-world Spider-Man. And sure, there's big construction projects going on all over the place down here. In fact, it's a great big bubble. Meaning that very shortly, when it busts, there won't be much construction work or architectural work for anybody. So unless he's got some particular extraordinary skill, I wouldn't put my eggs in that basket. By the way, the other day I got an email from a contractor up in Canada. Yeah, those Canadians again. Asking me how they could build houses so cheap in Latin America. Because I mentioned, if you know what you're doing, you could easily build a first world style house for $25 to $35 a square foot. Whereas up in the States, the national average is $125 a square foot. That's 4 or 5 times as much. So how can it be so cheap to do the same thing down here? Well, first of all, there's no basements here. Construction is all cement block, rebar, and plaster. Real plaster, by the way, not drywall unless you go really cheap, which is not recommended. Then, there's no insulation used here, not in walls, attics, doors, or even around water pipes. The houses have almost no air conditioning or heating ducts. Why? Because the climate's so nice, of course. And here's something very few people know. They don't have screen doors in Latin American houses. Just one main solid decorative door. And as far as window screens, well, they're just starting to come in now. They never had them before 5 years ago. Oh, and as far as windows and such, almost no one has double or triple pane glass. It's all single glazed. That goes for skylights, too. And since your average grunt worker on the job makes only around $300 a month, that's why you could build a 2,000 square foot house down here for under $100,000. Or one of 1,000 square feet for under $50,000. Not including the lot, of course. Okay, and finally, B says, regarding my expat insider seminar, she would love to come, but she says it would be great if there was a non-first world hotel option. She said she backpacked through Peru for a month and stayed in a hostel that was just fine. Well, I guess she's referring to the fact that we stay at rather first world hotels at the seminar. Basically, I settled on first world hotels because a lot of people have never been out of the U.S. or never been to a Latin country. Because so many of them are stepping into the unknown and don't know much Spanish, I'd like them to have a nice, soft landing from the start. And thus, we stay in 3- and 4-star hotels. However, at one of my very early seminars, I gave people the option to stay at a hotel that was called the Quetzal Roo. It's a highly rated hostel in Guatemala City, close to everything, safe. And I believe for a single, it's less than $20 a night. Whereas the 3- and 4-star hotels run close to $100 a night. Now, as much as I like to keep the group together at the same hotel, because then we're always running into each other all the time and it's a great place to network. There is still that option out there for anyone who wants to come down and do it backpacker style, in which case I can discount the seminar fee by about $500. So there is a backpacker option if you don't mind sharing a bathroom with a bunch of people you don't know. If you've ever done the backpacker thing, you know what I mean. That said, if you want to go backpacker style, I can recommend a hostel that's been rated number one in the whole country by TripAdvisor. I've seen it, and it is rather nice, except for that shared bathroom thing. I guess it's like how people feel about saliva. Your own, well, that's perfectly okay, but someone else's, yuck. So anyway, the point is to get your plan B underway before it's too late. And you can do that with me and my expat insider crew Saturday, July 9th through Thursday, July 14th. Just go to www.thenewexpat.com, click on Johnny's 2016 seminar link at the top of the page for full info and sign-up details. And remember, if you sign up before May 1st, you get a $500 per person early bird discount. Oh, and one more thing, if you do decide to come down, make sure you make some time immediately before and or after the seminar for those two amazing pre- and post-seminar trips that John Galt is organizing again. Okay, now, as promised, here's part 3 of my interview with Vince Villamina, the online taxman.com. So, direct from Medellin, Colombia, let's talk about expats and their taxes. All right, Vince, let's start off by talking about some mundane things, like, for example, what are the filing dates for expats?
First off, for the 2015 season, it's actually pushed back to April 18th. Oh, that's just because the 15th falls on a weekend. April 15th, 18th is when normal people file. But if you're an expat and you owe money to the IRS, you know, maybe through a pension, you would have to pay by the 15th of April. But your actual filing deadline is June 15th. And that's an automatic extension. There's no sort of filing that you have to do or extension you have to fill out. And if you do not make the June 15th deadline, then you could apply for another extension through October 15th. Those are the three deadlines. The only other thing I was going to say was for the FBAR, for reporting your foreign bank accounts, that's actually due June 30th. That deadline is actually set to change next year. There was a rule passed that said that it could be filed either April 15th, June 15th, or October 15th. Starting next year, the deadline of the FBAR will actually correspond to the deadline of when you file your taxes.
Now, I noticed you mentioned earlier something about when normal people file their taxes. And we know most people up north think expats are kind of crazy. Not me. I like to think we're slightly ahead of our time. I say just give it a year or two and we'll see who's still dancing on the deck of the Titanic and who's waving from that tropical paradise on shore. Anyway, Vince, an interview like this wouldn't be complete without asking what you charge for basic tax preparation for expats.
Just to give you an idea, I mean, everything's flat fee. It's really just based on forms and schedules need to be filled out. If you have an FBAR, if you have real estate, whatever. If you have questions, feel free to ask. I'm obviously here to help. And then based on kind of my understanding of this of your situation, then we would give you a flat fee. The first step is a free consultation. There's no obligation. It's just a matter of us talking, you asking questions, me asking questions, and then I'll give you a quote.
Then you would, I assume, direct them to download all the necessary forms, etc., right?
Yeah, so then if they were to sign up, we have like questionnaire. They would upload all the forms onto our secure portal.
So you say first there's a free consult. Then what about for later questions? You do those by email or by Skype or what?
I mean, again, like the follow-up stuff, like I said, it's all included in that initial price. And most of it is on email, just because generally it's one or two questions, et cetera. So it's kind of easy for both of us. If somebody is doing something complicated, right, like maybe they're starting a business, I'm fine with getting on the phone. I think it all just kind of depends on the level of complexity. Most stuff could be answered via email, but some stuff can't.
So do you want to be called Vince or Vincenzo or possibly Vinny? Hey, it worked for Joe Pesci, right? I mean, whatever happened to my cousin Vinny?
I was thinking about the other day, like, what happened to Joe Pesci? That movie was a classic.
Yeah, I agree, but just talking about it kind of shows our age, doesn't it? Now, Vince, there's one question that's been coming up more and more lately about Americans renouncing their citizenship and, of course, the tax consequences for doing so. And the odd thing is, before 5 years or so ago, nobody really talked about it. Once in a while, you'd read about some high-profile case in the newspaper, like Tina Turner or the guy from Facebook who had dual citizenship, Brazilian in the U.S., and he renounced and saved, what, $500 million in taxes, something like that? But now it seems with FATCA and all the extra reporting requirements, some Americans and people with dual citizenship have just had it and they're renouncing. Now, it's not like they're renouncing in great droves either. I mean, before 5 years or so ago, only maybe 1,000 or 2 would renounce a year, but now it's going up exponentially. And mostly it looks like with people who've got dual citizenship. Let's say you've got U.S. and Canadian citizenship. If that's the case, the U.S. government can and will pry into your financial affairs and often surprise you with a heavy tax assessment. And you know, if you do renounce, there is a stigma attached to that. People think you're unpatriotic and view it as kind of a slap in the face to the U.S. government. Or worse, however, I can't think of anyone who deserves a slap in the face more than the U.S. government, or at least all of its greedy, pus-brained bureaucrats and politicians, anyway. Oh, and by the way, I saw a Latin with a cool T-shirt the other day. It said, "The meek shall inherit the gulag." I'm sure he had no idea what it meant. That said, in your own tax practice, have you any clients that have renounced? And what kind of crap does the government put you through in order to achieve that?
I mean, as far as the process is concerned, it's actually just pretty straightforward. You have to go to the embassy. You set an appointment with the embassy.
Yeah, and I understand while you're there, you fill out a questionnaire with one of the points being, why are you renouncing? And then this year, anyway, you pay a $2,300 fee. Is that right?
It actually used to be free. Then it used to be like a few hundred dollars. And then once the renunciations became quite popular, then the United States government decided to say, hey, it's a privilege to renounce, so you're going to have to pay us for it.
So then what?
So you have to go to the embassy, submit the paperwork showing that you're renouncing, and it's not because of taxes. It's not related to any sort of financial means. You know, maybe having a closer connection to the country where you live, feel a closer connection to the U.S., you don't have relatives or something there. I mean, There's a number of reasons for doing so. I think the biggest thing to know is to not say you're doing it for financial purposes.
Say what? So even if you are renouncing for tax purposes, and I'm sure probably most people renounce for that reason, you're supposed to tell them that you're not renouncing for tax purposes. So then what happens if someone does write on that form that they're renouncing for tax purposes or because they don't want to file ever again? Suppose they're brutally honest on the form and say they've just had it with blood-sucking IRS parasites. Suppose they say on that form they just want out of a terribly rotten system.
I've never seen it firsthand because I've always schooled people appropriately.
In fact, I know a couple people who've renounced and they were also told the same thing, never to say on the form that it's for tax purposes. And they were advised to keep their mouths shut too and be civil. So again, you have to play their game to the very end, it looks like. So now they charge a $2,000-some fee. And of course, you have to be compliant up to that point, right? What are some of the other details we should know about?
Yeah, I mean, again, you have to be compliant the last five tax years for the most part. Technically, if you're not compliant, you could still renounce, but then you would be a covered expat. And so what a covered expat is, if you have over $2 million in assets, it's as if you have to sell all of your assets the day of renunciation. So you have to value all the assets of that day, which is easy if it's stock or mutual funds or whatnot, because you can easily see the value. But if it's some sort of real estate, et cetera, then you literally have to get an appraiser and get a value for it. And the point being is you do a fictitious sale of these assets, and then you pay an exit tax on that sale. That exit tax is like capital gains. And so this only applies to people that have over $2 million. And the first $2 million is quote-unquote tax-free. Anyone upwards of that $2 million pay tax of those assets that are hypothetically sold.
Now, after one renounces, I understand you get a certified piece of paper from the State Department saying that you're no longer a U.S. citizen, you've renounced. And that's the paper you show banks when you open up a bank account, proving you're no longer a U.S. citizen, and thus are able to open up a foreign bank account, since in the last few years, practically all foreign banks have refused to accept U.S. citizens as clients.
Yeah, you get a loss of citizenship document, which you can present that says you're no longer a U.S. citizen. And you're right, that could be used to open up bank accounts, etc.
Now, I understand once you're issued that document, you better hold on to that thing, maybe get it laminated and make some very good copies. Because if you were to lose it somehow, it's murder getting that thing replaced. The U.S. government really has no obligation anymore to put you on any kind of priority list. In fact, I've heard because you renounce anything you have to do with the U.S. government from then on, you pretty much get the brush off. So you say you have clients that have renounced. Did that act present any particular problems for them?
There was one guy that did have an issue getting back in the States once he renounced, but that actually had to do with the fact he had committed a crime before, like when he was still a citizen, with being a convicted felon. But obviously that's a very unique situation. Most people, again, they're allowed to get their visa to go back. They're allowed to see their family, etc.
So on this case where this guy had a felony, I suppose they don't have to let any felons into the U.S., right? Unless, of course, a few hundred thousand want to sneak through the southern border. Oh no, that never happens. In fact, just saying that could be construed as profiling or even a racist statement. Just ask Bernie Sanders or Hillary. But I digress. Anyway, what happened to that guy?
He wasn't allowed back in because he was a convicted felon, etc.
Now, as mentioned previously, when someone renounces, they actually have to get a visa to enter the U.S. after that. That means they have to go to a U.S. embassy or consulate in a foreign country and apply for a visa, tourist or otherwise, like everyone else. Now, there are rumors that when you renounce and you go for that visa to see grandma or go to a funeral or something, your friendly U.S. Embassy immigration officers aren't quite so friendly anymore. They look at you with a jaundiced eye, as if you spit on or burned the American flag or something.
It's a tough decision for a lot of people, right? And it's an emotional decision. Someone that works for the embassy that's representing our country abroad, you know, maybe feel a resentment for somebody that gave up their citizenship. I could see them not approving of this.
So then what is your feeling on where this is heading, and what are your recommendations?
I think this is definitely heading in that direction. I think more and more people are renouncing. I get more and more inquiries, etc.
And of course, people will lean on expat tax guys like you for advice on whether to renounce or not, I'm sure. Oh, and here's a question. Can you legally avoid paying that exit tax if you have more than $2 million in assets?
Right. Let's say they do have over $2 million in assets. They might be able to renounce and potentially avoid the exit tax into a foreign trust, et cetera.
So then there is a way to avoid at least some of the exit tax if you put it in a foreign trust, but you have to do that way ahead of time, I suppose, right?
Right. Up to $5 million. That's $3.4 million of exit tax savings.
So if you have a lot of dough like that, are you taxed strictly on capital gains?
It's capital gains. Well, it depends on the asset. It is a straight quote-unquote capital gains rate, but obviously there are long-term capital gains, there are short-term capital gains, there might be other tax rates if people have their assets like collectibles and gold and all that sort of thing. So we have to kind of pro rata calculate per asset what the tax rate would be and submit the 8854 form the day of the renunciation and their values to calculate the exit tax.
So then if a person is going to renounce, do you recommend they divest themselves of everything up in the States, you know, pay the tax and all that, but not own anything anymore up there? Just vote with your feet and get the hell out.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you have a business in the States, you know, you might not want to renounce just yet because obviously you're going to go back to the States. You know, if you have a lot of investment in the States, you know, real estate, et cetera, because actually as a foreigner, quote unquote, someone's going to be a foreigner if they renounce. As a foreigner, having a business in the States or having certain income producing assets like real estate, you actually have inheritance tax if the property is over $60,000.
So you're saying when you renounce, now you're a foreigner, so you may have to pay inheritance taxes if you own property worth over $50,000 in the States.
Again, I mean, you know, put someone at risk for inheritance tax if they're not resident. So people have to really look at their situation, both tax-wise, and figure out, okay, how much money am I going to be saving? How much am I going to be receiving the reporting requirements? What the potential exit tax might be? Consult your tax advisors, you know, make sure that you understand the tax implications and even some sort of tax planning, like I said, with potentially a foreign trust.
A foreign trust. So, yeah, you folks with real dough out there, you heard what he said, a foreign trust. So, Vincent, that kind of wraps things up, and if we have any more questions, we'll get a hold of you for whatever new tax situations for expats that might come up.
Okay, sounds great.
Thanks, Vince.
No, I enjoy it.
So, again, his website, theonlinetaxman.com. Okay, we're at the end of the show now, so let me remind you to go to my YouTube channel. Just plug in Expat Files or The Expat Files to see the slides that go along with the audio. And don't forget to subscribe. It's free.
South of the border.
You've been listening to The Expat Files, living in Latin America, coming to you twice a week from somewhere south of the border. Email me, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want me to help you sort out your own Latin American plans, schedule a one-on-one consult with me. Just send an email and let me know at theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.